Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
That, of course, was the voice of Brian Brown, who started the Brown Briefly, and who is with us in spirit. And this is Michael Shook, your host of the Briefly for today, seated right across from me. Part of our crew here today, the Brieflies, is the captain of our ship, he who keeps the sound mixed. Truman O'Brien.
Mixed. Be sure that's mixed.
Probably. Mixed, not nixed.
Right. That's right.
Captain Mix-a-Lot or something like that. Yeah. I don't know. I'm so old, I would have no idea about any of that. It's
Brown wired, it sounds, maybe.
To the left of Truman is Bruce Honorary Aussie Hallman's empty chair. Bruce Hallman is currently down under, and his chair still refuses to testify. So we move to the left again, where resides that tireless champion of progressive politics. I'm skipping you, Lynn. Kevin Jones.
Yeah, that's me.
Wait a minute. Wanted to say I was occupying the seat of the Guardian of the Galaxy, but my moniker is Mighty Mouse.
Well, there you go.
That works.
Here I come to save the day.
Someone's got to. Thank goodness.
I blame that on my social
work
career.
Now I'm going back. See, now I have to go right.
That's going to be. We're not used to that.
It's anathema to some.
An awkward step.
Yeah.
Okay,
so
let's see how we do.
So to the left of Bruce's empty chair, which actually is not there, is the authentic Georgia cracker, retired social worker, current poet, Lynn Kerrigan.
Oh, no. I cut into you too soon. I hate that.
No,
I hate people who interrupt.
You didn't interrupt.
Prematurely.
You were just jumping in there.
Interrupt.
Good morning.
Prematurely. That's almost redundant.
It is redundant.
Yes.
She says interruptingly.
I'm not going to go anywhere near premature. To Kevin's left is the... To Kevin's left. Where is that? Where are you? Susan.
I didn't know. There is more left.
Yeah, there is. And I'm not... Susan, you're not here somehow.
I'm not?
You're not on
No, there
list?
It is. Ah, like many, but not all on this island, we keep bearing left. Which brings us to former journalist, former GM of KVSH, and the current host of Real Talk, Susan McCabe. You are here.
I am here. Thank you very much.
I thought that was you.
Thank goodness. It would have been startling.
It's actually someone impersonating me.
It's a hologram.
I'm so confused.
It's a hologram. Yeah.
I hope our listener is still with us.
Are we still on planet Earth? I think the Gene Bosch studio may have
transported
to another space and time.
Let's head for the parallel universe that we want to have.
Yeah, we're on the Bolton Express.
Oh, my gosh. Speaking of that, so many topics to discuss. There is the ongoing, quote, trial of Trump, and I say that in quotes because it hardly seems like an actual trial.
It seems like a trial to me.
It's been a trial for the last week.
It's been a trial for many of us, I would put that way, for a long time here. Related to that, of course, is the potential bombshell of John Bolton's book, wherein Bolton states, according to the New York Times, that Trump told him, Bolton, directly, that the funds for Ukraine were to be withheld until the Ukrainian government said yes to investigating Joe Biden and his son Hunter and the Clintons.
And the Clintons?
Yes, there was he.
Why not?
He's obsessed. It's oh goodness.
He's obsessed with every previous administration. How come he's not asking them to investigate Obama?
I understand that they
happened.
Did. Actually.
I think
yeah.
he's.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Sure.
Closing arguments yesterday, I believe, it was Obama should be impeached.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
I don't
wow.
quite. Even if I had heard the logic, I wouldn't try to explain it.
Let's impeach Abraham Lincoln. This reminds me of the what I read about the trial by the Inquisition of the monk, priest, Meister Eckhart, who they pursued him around Europe, I think it was back in the 15th century, for close to a year. And when they finally caught up to him, he had caught some infection and died. But they had his body exhumed and held a trial whereby they condemned him for heresy and excommunicated him and threw his body off in an unmarked grave.
Excommunicate him as well as exhume him.
Yeah, that
this sounds like fitting punishment for someone I know.
Those guys were serious, that Inquisition.
they didn't mess around.
But we have like, 40, we could posthumously impeach 40 presidents, and there's 44 total other than the current one. So maybe it would keep the White House busy and they wouldn't like do damage.
No, if we impeached all the previous presidents, that would make Trump king.
That would be a bad thing.
The one left standing.
Oh, goodness.
Okay, we better get this one done then.
I do think it worth detouring from that circus for a bit and considering some of the other noteworthy events of the last 2 weeks. And I say that because this is gonna come and go relatively quickly. And this next topic, slavery and reparations, it's been with us for hundreds of years, literally, and it's going to be around after all of this. So what made me think of it was Monday the 20th, of course, was Martin Luther King Day, and it was celebrated grudgingly by some. And yesterday, the 27th of January, marked the 75th anniversary of the liberation by Soviet troops of the Nazi death camps at Auschwitz and Birkenau. And how are these events connected, you ask?
I know.
How are they?
Please.
How are they connected?
Teacher, I know. I think Martin Luther King Day heralds our sort of week celebration of our Black ancestors and the slaves who built this country and who were summarily, many of them, millions of them, died at the hands of capitalism in this country. And Auschwitz, of course, is a remembrance of the Holocaust where 6 million Jews were killed. And I think that what makes these two relevant to one another is that Germany has since then acknowledged their role in the Holocaust and made reparations to the victims of the Holocaust and worked at remembering it, making sure it's not forgotten and doesn't happen again. Whereas in the United States, we have tried to brush slavery under the rug. We talk about reparations in polarized conversations and don't really make any true effort toward providing reparations to the descendants of slaves here in this country. Nor do we acknowledge the Black Holocaust that killed millions of slaves. Mm-hmm. So that's the connection.
There well you said. Go. Yeah, that's
can,
it.
Do you know more about how the Germans paid reparations to survivors? Or
I don't know much. You know, I believe it was in the article that you pulled up, Michael.
Yes, it's fascinating. And so the German reparations, the effort was started in 1945, just 3 months after the war ended. And it was opposed by a lot of people, a lot of Jewish people living in Israeli and folks elsewhere. It was very controversial. So even something that seems so clear cut now was very divisive. Menachem Begin was led the opposition to it, and the bill to enter into direct negotiations with Germany was finally passed, I think, in 1952. So it took 7 years just to get that by a narrow majority in the Knesset. And then it was effected in 1953. And they eventually, Germany agreed to $845 million paid out to in different funds to the survivors and to the state of Israel and it was a major boost to their economy. It helped them get materials that they really needed to build their infrastructure. And but it's fascinating to me. And since then, in 1988, they allocated another $125 million. And in 1990, East Germany finally admitted for the first time its responsibility. agreed to some reparations. And in 1999, Germany set up a fund because of different lawsuits that were still pending against them. A fund called Remembrance, Responsibility, and the Future. And that fund had about $5 billion in assets. And it continues to be paid out each year in increments. So they're still working at making reparations. And moreover, I thought this was, what's been fascinating to me is that we talk about, well, we can't pass legislation here to ban the Confederate flag or to take down statues. These are very controversial things. But in Germany, there's been strong legislation. If you even have Nazi memorabilia privately in your home that you're not intending to sell it or anything else, that is a crime. You cannot have Nazi paraphernalia, memorabilia. The flag is banned. Those marches are banned. There are no exhibits glorifying Hitler or Nazism throughout Germany. And yet in this country,
look, you're looking at Germany, you're looking at 75 years, okay?
That's right? True.
And that's about two generations. So you can easily tell who are descendants of those people. The people who were incarcerated, the people who were killed, you can easily trace their descendants, correct? The end of the Civil War was, 157 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
And that's about how many generations? Maybe eight generations?
Somewhere,
There is no way. And one other thing, in Germany, that was a government-sanctioned program.
Mm-hmm.
The government did it. In the United States, slavery was not government-sanctioned. It just happened. That's number one. And number two, it's been eight generations. There is no way in the world that you could trace all of the ancestors of those people. You just couldn't. So how are you going to make reparations to those people? That's my question.
I think in this country, there's a gray area. And Germany basically gave piles of cash to those descendants. I'm not sure that's the best way to provide reparations to the descendants of slaves here in this country. Most black people, I just read, are in this country are 74% African heritage and the rest is white because the slave owners also use them to procreate. But slavery became the beginning of white supremacy in this country, and white supremacy dominates our institutions to the point that the descendants of slavery, all the black people in this country, are held back and disadvantaged by our system. So to my mind, reparations to black people in this country, the descendants of slaves, of which all black people in this country are, we don't have to be able to trace them. The reparations to them is more about giving them opportunities and funding those opportunities rather than handing them a pile of cash, which is going to be opposed throughout the nation anyway. But I think we need to look at ways to bring them up to an equal playing field in this country and dashing systemic racism.
I was thinking along those same lines as it was Michael introduced this topic, is that, there's one thing, a simple example is that where I worked, you could either get a salary raise or a bonus. And an increase in salary is durable. A bonus is not. So how do we create durable change that reflects the repression, right, that's been there? And is it a cash payment, or is it something more intrinsic to how society enables opportunity and creates opportunities, right, for this group of people? And I don't know if, Susan, that's where you're going, but that's what I kind of came to my mind.
I just wanted to comment on one thing, Truman, that you said. While the logistics, I agree, are complicated, for me, I would disagree that we did not have state-sponsored slavery. I think that in our Constitution it talks about you know, early on, slaves were counted as 3/5 of a person. They were not counted as a person. If that doesn't acknowledge slavery, I don't know what does. And so I think, you know, the complex part for me is that I agree the landowners and a lot of the private people were the ones who benefited most from slavery. There were a lot of white sharecroppers who certainly didn't benefit from that system
most
either.
Most whites
I understand
did not own
that.
Slaves.
That's right. Right.
Yeah.
And so that part, you know, I agree is amazingly complex, but I think that we should not ignore or give much wiggle room to the question of whether or not, you know, our system supported slavery, because I think it's pretty clear that it did until Abraham Lincoln, you know, tried to change that.
Emancipation Proclamation.
And the whole abolitionist movement that built up to that. When I was at university in Ireland, we had a speaker come and talk about the Truth and Reconciliation program in South Africa. And that was fascinating because they dealt with and are still dealing with many of the same problems that the United States is dealing with. A system of apartheid. We're not really comfortable in America saying that, but let's face it, that's what we've had for all these centuries. And it was fascinating how powerful that was for someone to come forward and say, this is what happened to me. And it wasn't a legal trial in the sense we were just trying to prove guilt or anything like that, but it was a witnessing,
you know, an acknowledgement.
Yes,
because I've read extensively about those Truth and Reconciliation movements that are often in Africa or some other places where there have been mass slaughters and mass atrocities. You know, kind of a one time, or you know, kind of a partisan nature, if you will, between tribes, and you know, just trying to kind of learn how do they manage reparations. And I think one of the things you're saying is that underneath the question of money and transfers of money, which we tend to in America break down everything to money immediately, that a lot of the principle was what was at stake for these victims. They were saying, we want it told and on record what happened. And
our
we
voices
want a
to
formal
be heard.
Apology. Mm-hmm. And we want to see legislation that will prevent this kind of thing from ever happening again. So I think we should not ignore these principles.
And I think that's key, Lynn, is the idea of principles. This is what I love about the 12-step program. I'm not in it myself, but I have friends. It's a surprise, I know.
there's hope yet, but don't worry.
Yeah. Oh, they're long pregnant pause.
I have friends.
May none of them be pregnant.
I should be in 4 or 5.
Where were you going with this?
Sorry, Michael.
No. That there's a step in there, and I can't remember which one it is, but talking with a friend, he said it's so powerful, and it's what you're talking
it's
about, Lynn. It's
recognition.
It's and the person is expected, if it doesn't cause more harm to the people he or she has already harmed with alcoholism or drug abuse of other kinds, to go to those people and say, This is what I am responsible for, and I apologize sincerely. That act of atonement is extraordinarily powerful, and I guess that for me is at the crux of monetary reparations aside. It's at the crux of what America never really has summoned up the humility.
No, we dismantled, you know, Jim Crow. I mean, we dismantled the Emancipation Proclamation and made it Jim Crow as absolutely soon as we could to keep our systems of oppression in place up through way past the 50s and 60s.
I remind my daughters that I was in grade school when African Americans in this country finally got unrestricted access to the ballot box.
Well, they don't have that yet.
No, they don't. We have systems in place that are keeping them out of the of the voting booths and keeping them in prison and unable to vote in prison.
Very, very systematically, yes. You know, I wonder, I'm not trying to justify why this country is different than Germany, but you know, Germany, I've had the opportunity to have colleagues in Germany and colleagues who are in government in Germany, and they talk about the fact that it is a national incentive, right, to recognize the atrocities that were committed in World War I and World War II. But and therefore, they are very committed to this over the long haul. But they also have the notion, the history of being disgraced in front of the entire world for what they did. So, and they were clearly losers. They clearly inflicted pain on almost the entire planet. And America maybe doesn't view itself that way. They don't view ourselves as having been defeated and having to come back and say we are sorry for the damage we inflicted. Mm-hmm. And maybe I don't. I don't pretend to say that might. And there's no explanation in my mind about why we're on this path. But maybe that's is something embedded in our culture that.
Well, that's an interesting observation, Kevin, because we did win, and slavery helped us win, helped us become the most successful capitalist country in the world. We would not be where we are today had it not been for the slaves who helped us build this country. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we talk about cash versus wealth and opportunity. And if we were to hand a bunch of cash to the descendants of slaves, well, that would be a nice little cop-out from responsibility.
Right.
And, you know, we could say, okay, done with that, on to the next thing. Mm-hmm. It's a whole lot deeper than that. We need to help African Americans and those who've been disenfranchised, including Native Americans.
I was just going to say, Native Americans,
yes.
Come on,
a lot
folks.
Of those folks were enslaved as well.
Well, even not even enslaved, I mean, just wiped out for crying out loud.
Right,
I mean,
mm-hmm. Right.
And it seems every, the Chinese who were here to help build the railroads across the country and how many of them perished. And, you know, my Irish great-grandparents who came to farm and ended up in coal mines, mm-hmm. and my Irish great-grandparents who came and similarly faced this, you know, rejection in this country. And clearly that's no equivalent to people of a different skin color who today you can easily discriminate against them because they're obviously bear the signs of a different culture, a different race.
For me, I think it's both. I don't think it's a matter of, you know, we have to choose between just, you know, an apology and cash reparations. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. I think both are needed to get the playing field. I can't imagine it will easily be leveled here. But I think a lot about myself. If I were to send in an idea for a way to do it, I'd be interested in seeing free education for every African American.
That's where I was.
Came from
great
here.
Start.
So
yeah,
my sister lived and worked on the Lummi Indian Reservation for more than 30 years, and my two nieces from her marriage are half Haida Yakima, half Dutch Irish, and I've also had grew up with a friend in Enumclaw who's half Native American from Southern Alaska, and the difference that it made in their lives, they having access to the education that they did, and it was a huge help. It wasn't completely free. There were strings attached, but it the opportunity was there. And my now ex brother-in-law was one of the first generation of Indians. Once that was that legislation was passed, he was one of the first generation to jump in there and go to school and get an education. And that's the generation that went back and said, wait a minute, this is a lawful treaty signed by two governments here. You guys better own up to your part in it. And that's what resulted in the just all of these things, the Bolt decision and, mm-hmm. and chief among them. But so there's a precedent there, and
yeah.
It and you look around the country now, around the whole nation, and tribes are building up because they've got that education. They've got people who are willing to do that work.
Yeah, there's another thought that's come to mind for me over the years about this sort of race relations and black versus white and so on. And it's the notion of, you know, what what we end up calling black is somebody who has some black relative in their history.
Mm-hmm.
And when Obama was running, it was like, well, is America ready for a black president? And I thought, well, you know, actually he's half white and he's half black. But somehow we become black, right? If we have
the
any
old
traits.
One drop rule.
Yes.
Well,
and it seems
part
like
part of our national bias.
Exactly. It's another institutional thing that, you know, is not something that we think about every day. But something this is where we categorize the other, and it's certainly unfair.
Yeah.
Right?
Well,
certainly
we made
unfair.
Black bad.
Yes.
We made
well,
black
that,
the
we did
bad
that
thing.
Too.
and actually, we did that. The notion of race was new with slavery. We were not identified by white or black or whatever before slavery, and the whole idea of a white race, which was better than a black race, was instituted with slavery, along with making
to
them
justify what we did
exactly mm-hmm. to make them not human.
That's
so
a fascinating
that otherize them.
Yeah, but Bruce has brought that up before about the all human societies enslaved. And have enslaved other people. I mean, the Native Americans here had slaves of all different kinds, neighboring tribes, et cetera. Sure. And I found in the little research for this, something that was fascinating. In 1650, there were more English held in slavery in Africa than Africans held in slavery in English colonies. Isn't that fascinating?
That's interesting, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, but there was the difference that you brought up, Susan, is that throughout history, there were ways that a person could, you know, well, we took him in battle or took that whole hundreds of people in battle. They could work their way out of slavery. They could do a variety of things. And once, if they did break out from slavery, there was no stigma. Just the luck of the draw, you wound up being enslaved for a while. And that's been true. Now, in America, though, it was all these things, to my horror, when I read Thomas Jefferson's comments about his own slaves, and I revered the guy, and still do for his intelligence, but holy cow. Yeah, he wrote dreadful things, and I think, again, as Lynn said, to justify.
Well, to me, this is a long overdue national conversation. And there are many things happening to stimulate this conversation. I know there was just a play at Langston Hughes Center's titled Reparations that was sold out. It was a big thing. I know August Wilson's play Jitney is coming. And August Wilson, the African-American playwright who was based in Seattle, is to me one of the America's magnificent original playwrights, because his cycles that he's been writing on is all about the African-American experience in context with their conflicts with, you know, their white bosses or landowners or neighbors or whatever. He's a wonderful writer. I just urge Americans, white Americans, to start being willing to think about this as something that we need on a soul level. We've got a lot of things damaging our character and our soul right now, and that's one of them. We could easily just say no more and institute some things that would be useful. But I think it requires us to realize that, you know, a lot of it is just inherent racism, you know, inherent racism. But I think there's also the smokescreen of the white capitalist society that use white supremacy as their smokescreen for maintaining control of all the money in the country. Mm-hmm. When we have 1% of, you know, the people that are controlling whatever it is, 80 or 90% of the money, it's not just about white supremacy. And the two get conflated, I think, about the economic opportunity in our country being highly controlled. And that has always been so. I don't know what to do about that.
I was doing a little research on this subject as well. And one of the things I found is that the 1%, back when we had slavery, were the majority of slave owners.
Mm-hmm. It 26 wealthiest people in the country.
That's right. Were the slave owners, and it wasn't the average white person. I think the way we average white people need to look at it now is that regardless of whether our direct ancestors owned slaves, we all now participate in a system that perpetuates slavery and perpetuates the holding back of African American people. And that's true nationwide. It isn't particular to the South.
Right.
And we need to take responsibility, not feel guilty, just acknowledge the fact that we do benefit from white privilege. We do benefit from a white favoring system, and we're not going to lose anything by helping others join us mm-hmm. on that level.
Yeah. It's kind of like that to go back again to that analogy that I used about the alcoholism and things. When you're in a family that has one or two alcoholics in it, there's that whole, it affects everyone.
Absolutely.
And it winds up being this guilty secret that is hidden away. And we're very good at compartmentalizing. I know I do it all the time. And so we've just got it sort of blocked off there in another room, and we never open that door. But it's there, and it affects us. And I think, like you said, Lynn,
it's corrosive.
It's corrosive to our soul.
Yeah.
I don't think that's too powerful at all to say it that way.
Yeah. Right. And I think I would say, if I can sidetrack just a hair, I wanted to bring up today that the state of Virginia passed the ERA, the Equal
yes.
Rights Amendment, which kind of sets another stage about an equality mm-hmm. legal battle. So we have these, and I'll go back and flesh that in a sec, but I'm fascinated with the fact that we have grand ideals. We can't quite seem to legislate them. And if we legislate them, we can't quite seem to live up to them. So, you know, we're a nation of idealists, and you know, I like that. I like that we struggle with these concepts. But I was kind of fascinated with this article in today's paper about the ERA, because I hadn't mm-hmm. realized that this was the last state needed to pass the ERA, because they had to have 3/4 of the states ratifying this amendment, which was proposed in 1923 and passed in Congress in 1972, but it had to have all 3/4 of the states to ratify it. There was the issue now is about whether there's a deadline for the ratifications, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. apparently there was a mention of a 7-year deadline, and then this deadline was extended to 1982, but at that time, only 35 of the 38 states had approved it by then, and it was declared a failure. And then other states rescinded their ratifications, Idaho, Kentucky, Nebraska, Tennessee, and South Dakota. And there was no provision for rescissions in the Constitution. And so they're all battling about whether the states that backed out can still be counted or not, and whether or not a deadline on something like this should have been kind of called or can be opened.
Called in the first place.
Yeah, so I find that's interesting. And so since 1917, Nevada and Illinois have ratified the ERA. And so Virginia is the final place, but if they don't count those 5 withdrawals, you know, we may be at some kind of end point.
5 withdrawals, meaning 5 states backed out of the
ratification? Yes. When I said Idaho, Kentucky, Nebraska, Tennessee, and South Dakota rescinded their ratifications when it was kind of declared a failure by its opponents
when they hadn't ratified. That's startling in itself that people back
that
out.
But the other
thing that's startling is the timeline that you mentioned, because you know, recent history is like the change of attitude in America to LGBTQ people has been like amazingly rapid, mm-hmm. whereas this is mm-hmm. decades. It's just startling.
It says a lot about the endemic misogyny in this nation. And, you know, I wonder if this resistance to ratifying the ERA is just a procedural question, or are there tenets within the ERA that if opposed, are going to benefit some group or another?
Yes. So let me mention this, because this article mentions that conservative opponents say ratifying the ERA would make it harder to limit abortion and illegal to separate the sexes in bathrooms, college dorms, and schools.
That's
sports.
Already happening anyway, the
so
latter.
If they're tying it to, you know, equal monies, you know, equal wages, that's a problem right there for a lot of employers.
Women could be drafted.
And if they're tying it to laws on our body that men don't have on theirs, that's another big issue.
If you look at the states that are not that have not yet ratified, it's kind of interesting. It's all Deep South.
Is it?
Well, it's a very conservative.
Except for Arizona and Utah, all the rest are Deep South, including Oklahoma. I don't consider them Deep South, but Missouri, Arkansas, Louisiana, and then across to North Carolina. Oh, excuse me, South Carolina.
So I guess it's part of the abortion battle.
It sounds like
it's part of it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I'm reading a book right now that is just fascinating. And I've mentioned it to you folks before. I think Jonathan Haidt, Haidt, and it's called The Righteous Mind. And man, oh man, that is a book that I would recommend to everybody, no matter where you are on the political spectrum, because he's a psychologist who has done an enormous amount of relevant and timely research into understanding how we come to our moral stances. And one of the first things that he realized in all this research was that we make our judgments intuitively and then use our reason to justify those intuitive choices. And this is what I see happening. You know, the old South, the old Deep South there, is responding to this from a completely different moral base than the left coast, you know, the heavily blue left coast.
The other irony of that fact is that those who have a higher intellect are able to more easily seek out facts to justify their emotional decisions, in the face of obviously logic that maybe that's not really the right decision. But we can find the right facts that make us feel that we should stay on the path we want to be
that
on.
That will support us in that. Exactly. Isn't that? It's fascinating.
It's much harder to change basic belief systems than it is to change opinions. And those basic belief systems underlie so many decisions, so many knee-jerk reactions.
And that's why I brought this up, because it seems like this conversation, whether it's about reparations or the Equal Rights Amendment, are part of the same issues, you know, in our country about sort of being founded on great democratic ideals and the rule of law, and yet the implementation and the rush to power and who gets included and who gets excluded in this country, because it's such a high-powered, uber-capitalist kind of society, you know, we don't stop much to talk about our values anymore. It's everything's valued by money.
That. I remember being stunned by when I was 11, when I saw this, watching TV, I was starting to get interested in the news with my dad. And watching the news with him and seeing the race riots and the folks demonstrating and fire hoses and the whole nine yards there. And I said, Pa, what's going on here? And he says, well, son, they're trying to get the right to vote. And I was like, wait a minute. I thought, you know, everything I'd been taught in school was everybody gets to vote when they turn a certain age. And then when the Equal Rights Amendment came up, I was 18. Just graduating high school.
The civil rights, you mean? The civil rights, not the equal rights.
This fast forward 7 years, and the Equal Rights Amendment gets announced and everything. And I was like, well, part of me said, why do we need an amendment? I thought everybody was supposed to be equal and everything. And then the second thought that followed on the heels of that was, well, who could be against that?
Yeah, that liberty.
In the South at the time, and I think I've told y'all that I was actually a lobbyist for the Equal Rights Amendment, and there were 400 people trucked in from the churches and on the day that I was there doing my lobbying, to argue that very point. That was their point, is that our system takes care of us, our men take care of us. Mm-hmm. You know, we like having our doors open for us. It was a whole system of the traditional family that was being questioned in their minds.
In their minds, yeah.
And
yeah.
they, well, and maybe legally, you know. So I think these are fraught things. They're very complex about people not wanting their lives to change.
You know, you brought up something that I'm still trying to parse out in my head, Lynn, and that was we're a nation of idealists. And I think we allow ourselves to say, oh, these are our ideals. And then we sit back and we let the people who are running the show do everything that is antithetical to those ideals.
Yeah.
Because we're white. We have white privilege. We can sit back and say, okay, well, I get just about everything I want and I'm equal.
It's demagoguery if it's just done for political reasons. That's what we have to remember when idealism is touted to make us feel better and to make us raise our patriotic national flag about how great we are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's maintaining the status quo. That is not about changing the status quo.
And Susan, I think you work, spend some of your time using your white privilege to help others. I mean, I think you've done some court watch and other things. Maybe the other people want to hear about that.
Yeah.
Because in other words, we're talking about this idealistic notion and a system that doesn't embody those ideals, but people can do things. So,
The organization that Kevin's referring to is Showing Up for Racial Justice, which is a Vashon chapter of a national organization, whose goal is to time goes fast. Whose goal is to help white people teach other white people how we are participating in systemic racism. It's part navel gazing, part help. But it is, because we need to look at ourselves very clearly and say, here's how I am participating in systemic racism, and then try to take action to thwart the results of that systemic racism, one of which is court watching when particularly people of color are brought up for clemency or resentencing.
Mm-hmm. So I'm sorry, I didn't mean to.
Well, we only have 2 minutes left, and I think Lynn's got something.
Well, I just wanted to add that... it's a challenge. I mean, we can be here on Vashon and thinking that we want to support some community that may actually not be present amongst us, right?
You're
because
right.
of our demographics. So, you have to move. You have to, that's the showing up part, right? Whether it's for racial justice, for other things, that we cannot contribute from a distance. I think we have to contribute by willing to go and join others and walk in their shoes, be in their space, develop the relationship, develop the trust, and only then, I think, but it takes work, and I think that maybe is an inhibitor.
It's really important that we allow people of color to lead us, that we don't go in like white saviors.
Absolutely.
Because they've got the answers, we don't.
And there's a really great book by Robin DiAngelo called White Fragility about the whites' reactions to being called on their sometimes unconscious participation in these privileged systems. It's hard to read, but important. I want to read at the end of the day here a poem by Mary Oliver, and I found it when I was reading about the Equal Rights Amendment coming up again and the generations of women who were taught how to be women by people that weren't women. Mary Oliver, you do not have to be good. You don't have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese high in the clean blue air are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over, announcing your place in the family of things.